and the decision in April, they should be handed over to Pappas. Concurrent discussions continued over finding what the protocols referred to as Ein Trefflicher Theolog to do the midday sermon at the cathedral, and later someone to conduct the visitations of the rural parishes. By this means, nearly all of the responsibilities held by Marpach before 1572 gradually devolved to Pappus, including the supervision of candidates for the ministry and their education. In fact, and in fine historical irony, when Pappus was finally appointed president of the Company of Pastors, it was Marpach's sagacity that was vindicated. The commission that recommended the appointment declared, and I quote them, "Although Pappus is quite young, still his degree compensates for it." In coming full circle, the Senate in 21 added that he was specifically charged with the supervision of the young theologians. Theological education in Strasbourg was therefore placed firmly in the hands of the church, and there it remained. What is it in sum that we have here? Put at its most basic, the second half of the 16th century, at least in Strasbourg, featured a wide-ranging debate over the status of theological education, whose outcome was to declare that the formal doctrines of true religion belonged to the church to define and to enforce. Moreover, this may well have been a development that was general to German Lutheranism. Lucas Oleander, in his Anti Sturmianus, declared, and I quote him, "that to explicate religious controversies reliably and to interpret sacred letters does," and this is in bold face, "does not belong to all people," end of quote. Sturm might be left to study Cicero's orations and those of Demosthenes and Homer, but in seeking also to judge religious doctrines, he was badly exceeding his grasp with his reach. This was the work of professionals. In the process, true religion became the providence of the church and consisted in the main of true doctrine. Therefore, in respect to the status of theological education too, there was a difference between the Reformation of the 1530s and the Reformation of the 1560s and following.
Methodus and methods of teaching law in the German Renaissance. In the 15th and 16th centuries, the traditional German state structure was transformed, one might easily say subverted, by an invasion of school-trained lawyers. Princely and municipal administrations came under the control of persons with formal juridical training, and chanceries passed from the hands of medieval scribes into those of lawyers. The leagues and associations which played such a large role in German public life came to be staffed by men with legal training, and they in turn functioned according to rules which only an academically trained jurist could understand. The strongest rearguard action against this encroachment of jurists was fought over the courts of law, but the establishment of the Imperial Chamber Court in 1495 marked the beginning of the end for traditional Germanic procedure and its lay practitioners. Soon every governmental and juridical institution in Germany had to operate according to Roman procedure, if only to preclude appeals. Lawyers were much in demand. One of the inevitable results of this rapid increase in demand for trained lawyers was the rush by ambitious young men to obtain law degrees. Germans of good family had long crossed the Alps to pursue training and degrees at one of the schools in northern Italy, particularly Bologna, Pavia, or Padua, though some Germans did go to the chief law school of northern France at Orléans. This flow would continue throughout the German Renaissance, but from the mid-15th century it was disturbed and diverted by novel influences. German law schools began to compete with the Italian institutions. They began, for one thing, to teach civil law rather than simply canon law, and the French invasion of Italy, which began in 1494, either disrupted the schools there or made it impossible for Germans to attend them. The humanist vogue in southern French law schools also enticed more and more Germans to Bourges and Avignon. Between the mid-1490s and 1521, the law schools at the many smaller German universities were in great ferment over the way lawyers were to be trained. At the same moment when the law faculties were being inundated with students, princes were heaping the jurists with heavy new governmental and juridical duties, as appeals courts and such. Starting in the 1490s, Italian academics brought in to start up or revive civil law programs in previous decades were being replaced with native Germans, though at first they were mostly Germans with Italian degrees. The result was that German law schools continued to operate according to Italian rules, and in true German fashion, they kept to the ultramontane model more stubbornly than was the case in the Italian schools themselves. In the Italian law schools, a clear line had never been drawn between the process of teaching and the scholarly enterprise as a whole. The law students, who had already graduated from an arts course, were led through the institutes of Justinian before hearing lectures on the Digest or the Code delivered by one of the premier professors. Extraordinary lectures by junior professors would also be delivered on other texts, but there was never an attempt to expose a student to the whole of the corpus of civil law. Rather, the student learned the techniques of legal argument and scholarship from a detailed exegesis of whichever few titles happened to be presented in the ordinary lectures during his sojourn at the school. If he wished to consider other titles or to gain a general view of the whole Digest, he would have to arrange for tutorial instruction or attend repetitions given by more advanced law students. The education was sealed by oral disputations and by the granting of the degree of bachelor and licentiate in law. If the student could come up with the stout additional fees required, 70 guilders with pomp, 50 without in Freiburg in 1524, he could then obtain the coveted title of doctor, which gave him the social rank of a noble. This system had been the target of criticism long before the 15th century, and the humanist movement raised scorn for traditional legal scholarship and teaching virtually to an item of faith. The scholastic method of balancing conflicting authorities seemed increasingly preposterous to those who saw that the glossators had completely misunderstood their text, if they had ever had a correct text to begin with. Further, humanist pedagogy stressed the systematic initiation of students to basic principles before advancing to more difficult materials. Young men were exposed only to that which they could understand at their particular stage of development. Many matters of scholarship would indeed always remain too advanced for the ordinary run of men, and these texts had no place in the educational process. The humanist critique slowly permeated the European educational establishment in the early 16th century, often working changes of pedagogical style even when there were no structural alterations. Another direction of attack on the older ways of teaching law came from below, from those who sought to popularize the precepts of learned law so that every man could become, in a sense, his own lawyer. Germans had had a long tradition of composing and publishing vernacular guides to canon and Roman law for non-lawyers. These built on the strong German language genre of law books, which went back to the Sachsenspiegel in the 13th century. In the fervid atmosphere of the 1510s, it was perhaps inevitable that someone would try to use the methods developed in popular literature to meet the demand for rapid basic training in academic Roman law. It's also no surprise that the first to try was the conventual Franciscan publicist Thomas Murner. Murner was both a born teacher and a man who knew a good opportunity when he saw it, and he made his debut as a law teacher at the University of Basel, where lectureships were almost as easy to get as quickie degrees. Murner presented his introductory lectures in 1518 and 19 on a salary provided by the municipal government. There is some evidence that he delivered these lectures in German, and he published several helps for beginning law students, other than or shortly after. These included a mnemonic exercise book on the fundamentals of jurisprudence cast as a game of cards, as well as a German epitome of the titles of Roman and canon law. And in 1520, he would publish the first German translation of the Institutes of Justinian. Murner netted severe criticism for his efforts, and in no case more severe than from his long-term enemy, Ulrich Tsasius, professor of civil law at nearby Freiburg and Breisgau. Tsasius first attacked Murner's student-pleasing antics as a law teacher in the Lucubrationes, published in late 1518, and he even threw in an obvious pun on Murner's name, so that people wouldn't miss the point. In late winter 1519, Tsasius wrote to Claudius Cantiuncula, then rector at Basel, to try to block the granting of a doctorate in law to Murner. Murner knows as much about the two laws as a blind man knows about colors, Tsasius declared. He also said that it would simply reinforce the widespread rumor that degrees were very easy to get at Basel. Despite these efforts, however, Murner was promoted. Boniface Amerbach wrote a comic letter on the subject about how the stone which was rejected is now made the cornerstone. He was promoted, and he replied to Clausius' attacks by circulating a satiric letter, unfortunately now lost. A full-blown battle was probably prevented by the outbreak of the Reformation crisis and Mourner's metamorphosis into Catholic polemicist. An examination of Mourner's efforts tends to support his critics. Mourner was a sort of professional teacher who regarded every subject as responsive to a single teaching technique. In fact, he peddled half-baked generalities concerning a law which was, in fact, an exceedingly complex historical artifact. Beyond the most elementary level, his technique boiled down to a brute memorization of superficially understood texts. The strongest objection, in fact, to his labors was that Mourner himself knew rather little law. If his approach had any defense at all, it was that he tended to see language itself as the key to expounding law. In that sense, he was both a humanist and a follower of Lorenzo Valla's ordinary language philosophy, which had been the harbinger of the new humanist legal method. Still, Mourner's vulgar techniques offended so many important people that he would have no academic successors in his generation, and German was not to be heard again in a legal lecture hall until the end of the 17th century. Clausius himself was the leading law teacher of his day, and he contributed both to the survival of the old teaching methods and to their reform. Although Clausius was an ardent humanist in his personal culture and a voluble enemy of the slavish following of authorities, he was also an early critic of Lorenzo Valla, Boudet, and other humanists who were too severe in their rejection of the medieval legal tradition. Clausius supported the idea of a recodification of the corpus of civil law by the emperor, but he remained convinced that logical categories could never rise above the rank of tools to explain texts. Although Clausius's freedom in explaining these texts was very great indeed, he often ended up siding with one or another of the despised glossators or post-glossators. He never subjected the legal educational system to a radical critique, perhaps because he was in no position to carry any reforms through. He was inevitably outvoted by members of his own faculty whenever he proposed anything. He was certainly distressed by the all-too-obvious greed of the law students who crowded into his classes in the 1510s. And he took the opportunity of his inaugural orations each fall to wave the banner for the higher calling of jurisprudence. He regularly reminded them that the great jurists who appeared in the digest almost all died dreadful deaths or died in poverty because of their devotion to the truth. The demand for speeded up training of lawyers was not likely to gain his support. He was, however, was not opposed to innovation. Clausius lectured on feudal law in 1518-19 and on legal rhetoric in 1521. And in the 1530s, he would give at least one course on a topic rather than on a title of the digest. He used regular Aristotelian categories for explicating legal texts, categories which resembled those which would become fashionable at the end of the century with the Ramists, and he occasionally used categorical graphs to make his points clear to students, another link to Ramism. In all these ways, Clausius' lectures pointed the way to the altered teaching patterns of the later 16th century, and they helped to explain why the texts of his lecture courses continued to be popular among students for a generation after his death. They were, of course, published against his will. There was a general conviction among younger German jurists of the generation born 1490 to 1500 that there had to be a methodus, a basic key to learning the vast bulk of civil law rapidly. There had been a great vogue for methodical teaching and writing in the period just before the Reformation crisis, notably by Claudius Cantiuncula and Johann Sichard in Basel around 1520. With the onset of the crisis, however, the pressure for reform was relaxed by the sudden drop in student enrollments, which reduced the incentive to shorten the time needed for degrees. Law faculties had enough trouble dealing with the virtual amputation of canon law from their repertoire. The secular governments, which now controlled most aspects of German academic life, seemed much less ready to reform the legal curriculum than was the case with arts or theology. In the late 1520s, when the shock of the Reformation crisis was wearing off, voices were again raised on behalf of a legal methodus. Once again, the proposals for reform were not well received by established teachers. Johann Fischart of Frankfurt played briefly in 1531 with a system which was supposed to give a student mastery of law in 2 years. and he solicited a reply from his elderly mentor, Tsasius. Tsasius replied that even Cicero had failed to reduce law to its basic elements, and that the best which could be hoped was a technique of exegesis for particular texts. The knowledge of particulars, not universal terms, was a subject of legal science. Law had no start and no finish, but thankfully it was not infinite. In summary, don't worry about a Methodist. The 50 books of the Digest are method and regular instruction enough for you. On another occasion, Tsasius was supposed to have said that he had passed a whole life of study and had never encountered such a thing as a Methodist in the law, had never even glimpsed it and assumed that it didn't exist. The correspondence of Tsasius and Fishart was seen almost at once by Simon Grinius, poetry professor at Freiburg, a recent refugee from Basel, and he tried to strike a balance between these two points of view. There had to be some means of getting through the mass of material heaped up by the law, and this process had to follow some sort of order. On the other hand, Grinius agreed with Tsasius that the text had to remain at the center of the student's attention. Still, Tsasius' approach demanded superhuman memory and stamina from an all-too-human generation of law students. Grinius felt that there had to be a reasonable balance between Galen's two paradigms of educational method, that by which a student worked from general principles to the specific, and that which drew general principles out of specific facts. Grinius concluded, then, that a method was necessary, but that this method could never operate independently of texts. Grinius' assertion that the actual text had to remain the warp, if not the roof, of legal instruction suitably typifies the prevailing opinion in German academia at mid-century. This reinforced the basic conservatism of German law faculties to make universities very uninviting places for methodizing jurists to pursue their careers. German graduates from those French law schools which expounded the radical new method called the Mos Gallicus had great difficulty finding a place back home. Of the budding systematic jurists of the German Southwest in the 1520s, only Sebastian Derer, who died in 1544, ended up making a career of university teaching. Claudius Cantiuncula, Johann Fischart, and Viglius of Ida van Zwischem all ended up as professional administrators or judges. Johann Fischart, who began as a reforming firebrand, had cooled down to neoconservatism by the time he became the leading law professor at Protestant Tübingen. And Tsasius's and Andrea Alciato's star pupil, Boniface Amerbach, never really hid his preference for the old Mos Gallicus after he returned to his native Basel. Dogmatic methodizers could survive as authors or as governmental apparatchiks, but not as teachers. Humanist juridical education in Germany in the 16th century largely exhausted itself in the rapid, systematic explication of texts and in the presentation of a few courses on topics rather than on specific texts. Those few Germans who developed their talents as philological scholars, such as Gregor Hollewander of Nuremberg, remain isolated figures. Ultimately, the adoption of the Mos Gallicus would prove to be impossible in Germany and Italy, since that was where Roman law still remained a valid common law, lex commune. Anyone studying the civil law in those countries had immediate practical goals in mind, and he had little patience with elegant jurisprudence in the Gallic fashion. In the end, a reformed Mos Gallicus would serve as a foundation of German and Italian legal education down to the end of the old regime and of the law which served it. In that sense, the humanist movement had only a marginal effect on university teaching and law. And yet there was a strong personal link between the brief humanist juristic renaissance of the early 16th century in Germany and the apparently imported vogue of Rheinism at the end of the century. The chief apostle of the ideas of Pierre de la Rene in Germany and Switzerland was Johann Thomas Frey, son of Nicholas Frey, who had been Ulrich Tsasius' last private secretary. Nicholas Frey had left his son a considerable number of unpublished manuscripts by both Tsasius and by Tsasius' pupil and immediate successor, Sebastian Derer. Johann Thomas Frey really earned his spurs as a jurist in the slow process of reading and editing these works. They were sort of a family fund which he worked, and they definitively shaped his own view of law. When Frey first met Ramus in Basel in 1568, he underwent a conversion to Ramism for which his reading had prepared him. Derer had already been a systematic theorist, and all that Tsasius needed was to be turned on his head by changing his exegetical method into a principle of organization, a taxonomy. Other Ramus peculiarities, such as the use of graphic charts to display logical constructs, had been common usage in Upper Rhenish pedagogy for the previous two generations. One unexpected conclusion of my investigation is, then, that in Germany, Ramism drew on genuine regional traditions, which joined Catholic Freiburg with Lutheran Frankfurt and Reformed Basel. Better legal minds than Johann Thomas Farrar's soon took up the Ramist cause, most notably Johannes Althusius. Although the Ramist reform came to find its home in Calvinist Germany, it fed on traditions which were the common property of humanist education from the start, in law just as much as in the other disciplines.
We must move on quickly. Professor Richard Harrison has just taken up his duties as Director of Doctoral Studies at the Lexington Theological Seminary. I think will be known to many of you. He's published on Melanchthon, Schwenkfeld, and on a large number of reformers for the forthcoming Dictionary of Living Religions. Professor Harrison.
I have 13 pages. I will cut.
You can go over a few minutes.
Yes, I will.
A few minutes late in getting going because of the transportation.
Yes. These three papers give us some indication of the significance of universities as a part of the 16th century European landscape. These and other studies which are now appearing with some frequency are also signs of our current recognition of the role of universities and university education in the general period of Renaissance and Reformation. That a cynic could also say that historical studies of 16th century universities says more about late 20th century historiography than 16th century intellectual life may not be too far from the truth, but be that as it may, and I do not think so on most days, each of these papers individually raise questions with which I want to deal and lead me to some general observations which I will make at the end of my response. So first of all, Lytle's paper. Lytle's paper reveals an institutional setting that is in marked contrast to Kittleson's. Oxford, standing in the tradition of the historical presence of Wycliffe, is an institution afraid to take a stand and yet terrified not to show the colors of orthodoxy. As Lytle has shown, the memories of Wycliffe were omnipresent, leading to almost frantic concern for the avoidance of heresy. So why was the response to Luther never officially published? Why was there never a formal condemnation of Luther, such as occurred in continental universities? Certainly there could have been a fear of royal reaction, that there could not have been a fear of royal reaction in the early 1520s, other than the reaction concern about Henry thinking that perhaps his response was sufficient. That point is well taken. But other than that, and I think it was met quite well, they certainly could not have feared any reaction from Henry in terms of being against Luther. What then kept them from acting? Why were the theologians apparently content to allow individuals to prepare and, for the most part, not publish their views of Luther? Lytle says it was a lack of nerve on the part of the university, and such may indeed have been the case. How does the presence of English humanism affect this mix? I think Lytle's picture of these middle-range figures of the period who were affected by humanism, who were still very much a part of the scholastic tradition, and it all somehow is weaved together. That is a very accurate description of the way humanism and scholasticism were working together among most circles of 16th century Europe. So how did the humanist tradition fit into this mix? I raise a question that I believe the answer is an obvious no, but I'll just raise it anyway. Could it be that the theology faculty representing people influenced by humanism, but also still part of the scholastic tradition, certainly not humanists of the Collett sort, could it be that they shared some of Luther's concerns? or that they feared that their own complaints about the church coming prior to Luther and their own expressed concerns for the reform of the church might be carefully examined if they said too much. This is particularly puzzling given the context in which Oxford theologians work. At Oxford, the theologians were in charge. Theological concerns could always receive high priority with control by theologians. The conflict over authority for theological education, such as went on at Strasbourg later in the century, was not an issue at this point in Oxford. Therefore, there are no readily apparent internal political considerations that might account for this lack of nerve shown by the theological faculty. And of course, there is still the Wycliffe problem. And there was apparently no little pressure on the faculty to do their job. Lytle has pointed out in other places as well as here the significant pressure on universities and a pressure that universities were seeking to express on their own, that university professors were the authorities in certain fields. For the theologians, they were the doctores ecclesiae, the teachers of the church. They were the ones with expertise. If you have a theological issue, turn to the universities. So why didn't they not take up this responsibility? So, I simply have a question here. Why? And I know you would love to answer that. I wish you had and could. And not had, but could. Yes. When you can, we'll all be grateful. In my view, if we can come to that, to an understanding of why they were so cautious, why they were so timid, answers to those questions could have a very significant impact on our understanding of the English Reformation. Now, Kittleson asks rather different questions, and yet touches on some of the same issues with which Lytle deals. He focuses on the following question. Was the status of theological education also at issue in the transition from reform to confessionalism during the late Reformation? He believes that indeed it was, and that the historical process that occurred in Strasbourg is telling in this regard. As was the case in other universities that came under Protestant authorities in the pre-1555 period, the fledgling educational system in Strasbourg was under the guidance of reformers who were themselves either humanists or influenced by humanism, and one needs look no further than to other places such as the important role of such as Melanchthon in Wittenberg, Blind in Erth in Tübingen, Calvin in Bertwitz to become much later university in Geneva, and of course Capito in Bützer and Hadio and all the others in Strasbourg. In each case, whether by reforming an existing institution or by participating in the development of what would later become the university, the reformer humanists or humanist reformers were the primary movers and shakers behind the restructuring of the university for the purposes of the Protestant Reformation. And further, that there was an alliance, whether holy or not, between theologians who were humanist reformers and humanists who were not professional theologians. That there was such an alliance between these two groups is very clear, and that there was a built-in conflict to come later is also clear. Kittleson's question then is, what happened in the age of confessionalism to break this alliance? Further, who or which side, the theologians or the humanists, remain loyal to the intentions of the original form of reformers of the school? Kittleson points out that while tradition has affirmed that Johann Sturm may have stood closer to the tradition of Gutzer and Capito, in reality, insofar as we are dealing with theological education, Marbach represented both the ultimately victorious side and also the basic concerns of the first generation reformers.
I agree with that interpretation. And the reason for that, for my agreement, is that the primary goal, there were lots of motivations and concerns being expressed by such as Capito and Bucer, but certainly the primary goal that they had was the reform of the church and the work of the church, the ministry of the church, so that whoever had that as their primary goal in working with the university was going to continue that kind of tradition. But of course, to divide all of the influences that led Capito and Bucer in those early years to form a school, to divide that later in the century, is then to divide their motivations. Obvious, but it's always something we have to keep in the forefront. Kittleson also makes the point, and should be emphasized, that Protestantism, after 1555, had moved into a period of theological consolidation and clarification, a time of seeking proper direction now that the guiding stars, the giants of the first generation, were no longer present to referee any and all disputes. I'd like to emphasize what Kittleson says also on page 13 of his manuscript. The position of Laubach and Pappus and the church also had its own integrity. That is sometimes hard for us who, regardless of our particular theological positions or lack of saying, we identify with humanists. We do. And so it's hard for us to recognize the integrity of what a Laubach and a Pappus were saying. Now, let me skip some here. The question raised by Sturm about the primarily educational function of the study of theology in the university was to approach the issue with assumptions that simply were not shared by Baerbach and Pappus. And further, Sturm's views may have affected some of the tension that Kittleson noted early in his paper between the humanist who had theological concerns on the one hand, and the professional theologian. Again, we're getting back to the idea of incipient professionalism in the 16th century. I find this very interesting. It seems to me that we see a similar thing happening throughout intellectual life everywhere in most periods. Today, for instance, as an analogy, imagine a conversation in a faculty lounge where there were historians and philosophers and literary professors present, and a novel or a poem comes up for discussion, and a couple of historians and philosophers have read it and love it, and they are talking about it and excited about it. The literary professor is sitting over here and sees them invading his or her turf, and will dismiss much of what they say and will speak with perhaps an air of disdain. It happens all the time, and I believe that that was part of what was happening at that particular time. On the other hand, what Sturm represents is what we see today as sort of a liberal arts approach. Many of us resent the idea that specialization has come to such a point that all of us who are educated cannot have a say in a number of issues. Perhaps more importantly for Sturm, or at least equally importantly for Sturm, is that he was a Christian humanist, and that humanism had, even before the Reformation, at least some tendencies towards what Luther was then to make as a major issue, the concept of the priesthood of all believers. So that Sturm as a humanist was unwilling, as a Christian humanist, was unwilling to have matters of faith put completely in the hands of certain professionals. As an educated person, as a devoted Christian, he was unwilling to do that. And that may also be a part of what was going on there. And so what we may also see here is a continuation of this tendency towards specialization that is certainly growing in the 16th century. Let's skip some more here. Now, a final question for Kittleson. You do not tell us what persuaded the magistrates of Strasbourg to take the position which they finally took. I assume there's simply no evidence. Why did they finally decide in favor of the authority of the church? What is the rationale for that? They changed their mind. I can think of lots of reasons. I assume there simply isn't evidence to allow you to say why. And that, I would like to know that. And later, if you have any guesses, hunches, hints, or anything, I'd be interested. Now, very briefly on Professor Rowan's paper, if you listened to what he was saying about Zosimus's attitudes towards students, greedy, they wanted shortcuts, they weren't interested in the great ideas of jurisprudence as a profession. He's obviously been teaching undergraduates recently. Or perhaps those, I have friends who are teaching law, and it's the same thing. And then there was Mortimer. Being one who is enamored with Martin Bucer, yes, Mortimer is a bad guy. I assure you he is a bad guy. I find it fascinating, though, that in the study of law, while humanism had its very brief period of some influence, there was so little reform of the teaching of law as there was a great reform in the teaching of theology, the teaching of arts, and I'm wondering why. What was happening there? Is it perhaps, I just raised this question and would like your response at some point, is it possible that on the one hand, law as a profession is a very conservative profession, so that reform becomes particularly slow in that area. And then secondly, that in that particular period, the best minds of the German-speaking region were concentrating in other fields, the arts, theology, for instance, so that if Zosimus represents perhaps the best German legal mind of the first half of the 16th century, perhaps as his ability, core ability as a thinker is not equal to that of the best people in some of the other fields. So that what we have is a period of weakness in a particular profession. I don't know, but I would not be surprised if that were not the case. Finally, and in conclusion, the study of universities, university life in the 16th century is very important because much of the profound shaking and shaping of intellectual life, and certainly in terms of law, what was happening to legal systems and to forms of administrating governments and the development of the bureaucracies cursed them forever and ever, for the development of the bureaucracies that was going on at that time. In looking at the universities and looking carefully at what was going on there, we are going to have a much better understanding of what was actually happening throughout the period. This is important research, and these are good papers. Thank you.
I see it's exactly by my clock, 15 minutes to the hour. We're hitting